Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know?
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns and the Rivertown Kids on the Grammy award-winning Solartopia song, the great Pete Seeger. No longer with us in body, but with us in spirit for generations to come. One of the great people of all time. David Burns, a wonderful songwriter, wrote the lyrics to that. And Dar Williams joined us that beautiful day in Beacon to sing the song, the Solartopia song with us. We are back for another Solartopia Green Valor and Wellness show. I thought maybe after the devastating information about Fukushima and the children dying there, tens of thousands of children around the Fukushima nuclear reactors stricken with thyroid problems and thyroid cancer to the tune of 40 times normal. We needed a show with some upbeat and some reality in where we actually can go on this planet towards a green-powered Earth. And so I'm joined by two guests. Aaron will be with us at the end of the show, but also, most importantly, for the beginning, with my old friend and good buddy and one of the great pioneers in the unsung pioneers in the Solartopian movement, the movement to a green-powered Earth, Francis Koster, Francis P. Koster, Ed D. Do we call you Dr. Fran?
Why don't we call me Fran?
All right. Well, how about Dr. Fran? Then you can have like a talk show. Tell people, give people advice. But you will give us advice. Fran, you are a veteran of more than 40 years now in the movement towards a renewable-based Earth. You were one of the key organizers, if not the key organizer, of the series, the Toward Tomorrow series, that culminated in one or more fairs. You can tell us about that. In Amherst, Massachusetts, a town that needs to change its name, by the way, and we'll talk about that some other time, at the University of Massachusetts back in the 1970s, for God's sakes, promoting a renewable green-powered Earth. And among the people that, you can tell us who, among others, participated in this series and this fair, the Toward Tomorrow reality back at UMass in the 70s.
Let me give just a little bit of background so people can appreciate what we're trying to do, and then I'll tell you who showed up to help us do it. I went to UMass Amherst to a program that existed then called the Program for the Study of the Future. And it was a serious academic program that was concerned about population growth and environmental issues, dependency on oil, and so forth. And there was ample evidence, even back then, that we were on the wrong course. And yet, in spite of all of the evidence, we didn't change course. And so I got particularly interested in why leaders don't listen to warnings. And so I went there to study that at the School of Education under the notion that we had to be better teachers of our leaders. And one of the things that I discovered when I was working in that field was the worst person to give a warning to is an affluent white male. And the best person to give a warning to is a young mother.
And what kind of warning, Fran Koster? What kind of warning are we talking about here?
Well, any kind of warning at all. If you wanted to, for example, back in the day, before seatbelts were widely used, there was buckle-up campaigns. and they were phrased as buckle up, you'll save your life. Those campaigns didn't work at all. When the campaign switched to buckle up or your children won't, all the adults did. So they began to act on behalf of somebody else, a dependent, a vulnerable population.
Well, let me ask, since you're on this, I know we're going to broaden this out. In terms of seatbelts, how does the term quicket or ticket work? In other words, the threat of a ticket if you're not belted in.
It is not nearly as effective as an image of a young mother gazing lovingly at the child and saying, your child will do what you do.
Wow, very interesting. Okay. All right, so proceed then. So you were studying why leaders don't take warnings, and tell us why.
Well, most warnings are couched in the first person. Sluggo, if you do this, you're going to get hurt. If you do a certain kind of drugs, you're going to shorten your life. If you are wasteful with money, bad things will happen to you, and it's all aimed at you. Those are not terribly effective. And the more resources you have, either as an individual or as a country, the less impactful those warnings are. So if someone comes to me and says, you're indulging in something that could cause you harm, and I know I've got health insurance and money in the bank and so forth, I'm less deterred. But if I'm poor and have no health insurance, I'm apt to pay more attention to it because I can't afford to be wrong. So what we have in the United States is a country that feels bulletproof about a number of things. We have a number of problems headed our way, and we think that technology will save us or get us out of the mess, whereas other countries who may not be quite as blessed from a natural resource point of view said, well, this is dumb. Let's figure out an alternative.
Well, give us some specific examples of things that have been rolling towards the United States to which our leaders seem immune to taking steps.
Well, your audience is well familiar with all of the list of horribles from climate change to the death of the fisheries to changing nature of food supply, rising rates of neurological damage, any one of which we can talk about in more detail. But there are, if I could dwell just a minute on the nature of things that you warn people about, it's easy for someone who is environmentally aware or health aware to start throwing statistics around and scare the heck out of anybody. The rising rates of autism in the United States. We could start talking about numbers that would literally curl your hair. But it's disempowering to the person who hears that warning because they don't know what to do. And so their normal psychological response is to cover their ears. They cannot stand to feel scared and powerless. And unfortunately, much of the environmental community has used the strategy of, I'm going to scare you but not tell you what to do.
So, well, that's interesting. I mean, give us some examples of that in terms of the movement for the planet. Where would you say that's been true?
Where we've scared people but not told them what to do?
Yeah.
Well, back in the 70s and 80s, there was a large concern about generating electricity from oil and coal, and that we should switch, for example, to nuclear power, which is beyond the implementation ability of any one citizen. Some big other organization has to do it. So it's not my problem. I mean, somebody else will take care of it. So, but if you say to people, and we did this, I was a consultant to a number of electric utilities back in that time, and we would say, we've got significant problems with balance of payments from imported oil or water pollution caused by coal mining or something like that. If you turn down your water heater, you will help make a contribution. And then we have to come up with cleaner sources of fuel. If you insert the notion that you are not powerless, you can do something. Just by creating the sense that one can do something, the warning is allowed to penetrate psychologically. And then you get an alert and aware electorate, citizens who gather, because you haven't scared them and made them feel powerless. You've alarmed them and you've made them feel powerful. And that, in many cases, is where the environmental movement in the United States has not done as good a job as it could.
Well, there's a woman named Lorna Salzman, and she's a friend of mine. I don't know if you know Lorna, but she is extremely critical of the various movements on global warming for not pushing, solutions. And I have to say, when I saw Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore, there are all sorts of things at the end that he said that people can do in their own homes, but he'd never talked about taking on the corporations that promote what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, in the political arena. What do you think about the dichotomy between people acting in their homes to, as you say, turn down water heaters, as opposed to or in conjunction with going out and taking on the big corporations?
Well, generally speaking, and you've been around political movements as long as I've known you, you were out there marching in a number of causes and trying to educate people. But you also walked the talk personally. And so when you were speaking about alternative futures, you were already living one. And that lent you credibility, and you were able to get people to mobilize behind you because you had integrity about what you were doing. Where we have some struggles is where we say to the average fellow on the street or the average college student or something like that, let's worry about King Kong. But we don't call them and say, by the way, are you shutting the lights off in the classroom when you're done? This individually implementable piece is important not because it saves energy alone, but it's important because it holds people responsible to walk the talk. And when they walk the talk, they begin to walk it bigger and bolder and then form movements.
Well, I got to say, you raised the question of turning off lights in classrooms. I teach at two colleges here in Central Ohio. And it's amazing to me how many lights are left on. I mean, I go around turning off lights all the time. I have had a couple of amusing moments when I've turned off the lights in restrooms and people were still in there, but otherwise.
Well, I was just at a meeting. But otherwise, in North Carolina, as you know, and I was at a meeting recently. We have a local sustainability council, and we heard a report from the sustainability director of a local school system who managed to reduce their electric bill by 30% purely by behavior change. They did not buy a single piece of hardware.
Well, what did they do for behavioral change?
They educated people about shutting lights off and lowering thermostats during the winter and so on and so forth. Now, there's a limit to how much you can save with that. But once you begin to do that, then where you get is an informed audience, a class of students, if you will, who no longer feel powerless. And then you can begin to take on and organize yourself for larger things. So,
let me introduce you, Fran. I'm going to have you introduce yourself. We're talking with Fran Koster, author of the new book, Discovering the New America, one of the great pioneers in the solartopian revolution now sweeping the world with renewable energy and increased efficiency. I can't even begin, Fran, to, and by the way, Fran does call me Sluggo. I've asked him to go ahead and do that. That was my name back on the old commune. I like to think it was given to me because I was a pretty good baseball player, and I do find that the older I get, the better I was. But Fran, tell us a bit about yourself, please, as we proceed, and why your opinion is so important on these issues.
Very briefly, I come from a small town in Ohio. I was the oldest of six kids, and I learned early to try and take care of others. I went through high school, went in the military, came out, went in the Peace Corps, was 3 years in Africa, learned a great deal about how blessed we are in this country, and also how societies hurt their members when there isn't enough of something to go around. So if you don't have clean water or food, you get a rise in violence. And those 3 years in Africa...
Fran?
Yeah, they marked my soul. And when I came back, I tried to figure out how such pain and suffering could exist when the solutions were known. And I got deeply interested in the question of presenting concerns, warnings to people, and that led me to why people don't listen to warnings. So in the early 1970, I wrote a couple of papers in my graduate work. One was predicting the first oil embargoes and assessing the impact on the New England economy. And the second, and as you know, the 1973 oil embargo happened, and I was one of the few people around who'd ever thought about, oh my God, what are you going to do?
And what made you, predict it that it would be an oil embargo? What were the warning signs?
Just what I call excessive dependency. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. If you become excessively dependent on it, if it's disrupted, then your life is destroyed. So it could be air, it could be water, it could be fuel. Early on, I adopted Maslow's hierarchy of needs as an organizing principle. So in my own writing and study, I think about air, water, food, and fuel, and the public health consequences of how you meet that, those needs. So
okay.
Then I went, I beg your pardon, I went, worked in higher education reform for a while, started the utility program, renewable energy program at UMass, was hired then to run the renewable energy program at the Tennessee Valley Authority, did that for a couple of years, and then when I left there, I got recruited to work in the area of pediatrics as an innovator in health policy about the health of newborns and children. So I then spent 25 years working with an organization called the Nemours Children's Clinics, which when I joined it had about 5 doctors, and when I left had 450. And we dealt with, as a clinic, was kind of a male clinic for children, we dealt with, by and large, the sickest of the sick. And I got even further educated. I was blessed to work with some extraordinarily compassionate and talented people who taught me, a non-science, non-medical guy, a lot about how our environment hurts people if it's not clean and safe. And so...
Hello, Fran?
Hello.
Sounds like we had a phone in the background. Yeah. And so you were also the first renewable energy coordinator for the Tennessee Valley Authority. Is that right?
Yes. I don't know what happened here. I'm sorry, Slug.
That's all right.
Shall I call you back?
This is the perils of doing a radio show on the telephone. We're talking with Fran Koster, author of Discovering the New America, where local communities are solving national problems. He is a very important, longstanding pioneer in the renewable energy industry and an organizer of the Toward Tomorrow Fair and series that was at UMass, University of Massachusetts, in the mid-1970s. Fran, you back with us? Oh. Fran, have you disappeared? I did want to talk. I'm sure he'll come call us back. Since I mentioned it earlier in the show, I said something about the town of Amherst, Massachusetts needing to change its name. And, you know, we have this tremendous, wonderful national campaign going on to force the football team in the professional football team in our nation's capital to change its name. And, you know, I'm 100% in favor of this. It's an absolute embarrassment that this professional team, and I do follow the NFL, National Football League, still bears a racist slur, as its, professional name. But what people have been talking about, and I haven't decided whether to launch this again, is the fact that the town of Amherst, Massachusetts, bears the name of the guy who introduced conscious germ warfare into the North American continent. Lord Jeffrey Amherst, in the middle of the French-Indian War, deliberately gave blankets from a hospital where he knew there was smallpox to Native Americans with the intent of giving them smallpox, smallpox having killed as much as 90% of the native population in the Western Hemisphere upon the arrival of white people. And so the fact that there is any town at all, let alone 36 towns and counties in North America, named after Ward Jeffrey Amherst, to me is a horrific insult to everything that's decent. And I hope that the town will rise up and get his name off that town. He has, Fran is having trouble with his line. Let's take this opportunity to talk with Aaron. Aaron, are you on with us? No, Aaron's not either. Okay. So, Fran Costa will call back. Fran was one of the, organizers, a principal organizer of something called the, Toward Tomorrow Fair, which happened at UMass in the 1970s. And among the many participants in this Toward Tomorrow Fair, was Amory Lovins, and another was, William Hieronymus. Amory was and remains one of the world's leading experts and advocates for renewable energy. Amory has a mind like a steel trap. He's kind of the Einstein of the renewable energy world. And I met him at UMass in 1975. He was an inspiration to us all, and he continues to work avidly for a renewable energy future. And his speaking at the Toward Tomorrow Fair in 1975 gave us a vision of Solartopia, of a green-powered Earth that we can convert to, where all our energy will come from solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels, and all that stuff. And Amory is still very much on the case. I'm hoping to get on the show one of these days. His title of his most recent book is The Rediscovery of Fire, or Reinventing Fire. That's what it is, Reinventing Fire. And Amory runs the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's the chief scientist there, rmi.org, in Aspen, or just outside of Aspen, Colorado. Fran, you're back on with us. I have just ranted for a while about why we must change the name of Amherst, Massachusetts. I think I'm going to hold off on that until renewing that campaign. We had a great name, actually. I don't know if you were in. You were in Western Mass when I published an article or two in the Valley Advocate advocating that the name get changed. There was a pretty good response, actually. We ran a little kind of contest to come up with a name for Amherst, and somebody came up with one that I think is perfect and that I think will stick, which is Emily, to honor Emily Dickinson, the great poet who lived her life in Amherst, Massachusetts. I'd love in our lifetime soon, I hope, to see that town's name changed. But let's get back. I was talking while you were off, Fran, about the Toward Tomorrow Fair. Tell us a bit about the Toward Tomorrow Fair and the Toward Tomorrow series that happened at UMass in the 1970s.
When the insight began to grow that you simply can't tell people the sky is falling without telling them where to go to be safe and what to do about it, the idea of identifying positive visions of the future took root. And there were a number of us at the Program for the Study of the Future who put together, first of all, some evening classes and then summer school, and then we held this big fair series called the Toward Tomorrow Fair. An example of the kind of people we had at this was Ralph Nader, Herman Kahn, Helen and Scott Nearing, Dr. Bill Hieronymus, who set up the windmill program there at UMass that pioneered wind energy to the United States, Jeremy Rifkin, Stuart Brand from the Whole Earth Catalog, Sam Lovejoy was there,
Margaret Wright, Ty Cashman, Jerry Glenn, his Gill friend, the people who set up the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, David Morris. It was just a gathering of people who knew that we could not go forward with the same tools and behaviors that we had used in the past. And so we covered the quad with solar collectors and ways to build electric cars and ways to do hydroponics. It was just astonishing. And I think the last one we had 28,000 attendees, if I remember right.
Wow, 28,000 attendees. And what year was that?
The one that I was, the last one I was connected with was 76. So I may be wrong on that number, but it was massive. It lasted 3 days. It was wonderful.
Yeah, that's the one I remember. So that really was the birth of the Solartopian vision, was the idea that we could convert our coal, oil, nuke, and gas economy to renewables. I don't know if there are any parallel, similar fairs like that anywhere in the world outside of Amherst, Massachusetts. And Fran, you were the chief organizer, so you deserve a tremendous pat on the back for that. Well, also, as I recall, was William Hieronymus was there. Can you tell us about William Hieronymus?
Yes. In fact, I just spent several days at UMass Amherst at the Wind Energy Conference there. Dr. Bill Hieronymus was an admiral in the Navy, in the nuclear Navy, and grew concerned about a number of issues. And he, as you might know, as a nuclear engineer, he was by personality enormously data-driven and punctilious. He wanted everything, the T's crossed and the I's dotted and so forth. But he was also sort of your, I don't know, stereotypical military leader. He was ramrod straight and stern and so on and so forth. But he determined that we needed to develop alternative forms of energy. And he got deeply involved, given his marine architecture background, in windmills, building on his knowledge of propeller design and so on and so forth. So he came to UMass and set up the first windmill energy program that I'm aware of any place in the United States. And most of the leadership of the American wind industry came out of UMass Amherst.
Wow. Now, what year did he establish that?
I'm not exactly, well, let's see, they just had the 40th anniversary, so it must have been 74.
And I think there was an institute at the time at RISO in Denmark. Or were there any others that you know about around the world?
I'm not familiar with them, but that doesn't mean there weren't. When you are a futurist, your knowledge about things sometimes gets to be an inch deep and a mile wide, so...
Well, you call yourself an optimistic futurist. I don't know how there could be anything but an optimistic futurist, but would you say that the wind visions that William Hieronymus was putting forth at the Toward Tomorrow Fair in the mid-1970s has been realized?
It would. Windmills currently in the United States are, with the exception of old hydroelectric power, windmills are the most economically competitive to any new electric generation capacity we have. Now, this is changing enormously quickly. And in a year or two, the solar, various forms of solar are going to have that honor. But for the last 4 or 5 years, head-to-head, it's been cheaper to make steady electrical power from wind than it has been from a new coal or new nuclear plant.
Well, thankfully, there aren't going to be any more new nuclear plants, and a lot of coal plants are getting canceled because of this. We're talking with Fran Koster. Fran, when we come back, I'm going to ask you some specific questions about how many people are actually working in the solartopian industry these days as opposed to fossil and nukes, and how much money is pouring into this optimistic future that you you so foreseeably, for presciently, let's put it that way, featured at the fairs. And of course, you're doing it still today. Talking with Fran Koster. Later in the hour, we'll be talking with Aaron about his green business. But we're going to take a 3-minute break. We're going to hear my buddy Dana Lyons sing the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. And we'll be back right with you in about 3 minutes.
plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solar Tokyo is home sweet home to me.
Dana Lyons, my good buddy Dana Lyons. Cows with Guns is Dana's signature YouTube. Over 2 million views for Cows with Guns, the vegan anthem as the cattle rise up at the feedlot and take over the world. Don't miss it. Cowswithguns.com, I believe, is the tag, or just go Cows with Guns on Google and get to YouTube. We're talking with Fran Koster, my good buddy Fran Koster, organizer of the Toward Tomorrow Fairs back in the 1970s, and renewable energy, first renewable energy chief at Tennessee Valley Authority. Fran, can you give us an idea how much of this Solartopian vision has come true? How much, do you have any idea how much money is now invested in renewables and how many people are working in the industry in this country?
You catch me a little bit short. I can't come up with a lot of it, but here's some interesting ones that I do remember off the top of my head. A little while, as you know, I write newspaper columns and a site called The Optimistic Futurist. So the statistics I'm about to cite can be found there along with their footnotes. Now, there's about 150,000 people employed directly in solar. And what's interesting about the wind energy piece, which is not counted in that previous number, I went back a little while ago to find out how many people were employed in coal. And so if you go to the U.S. Department of Labor statistics, they'll tell you how many coal miners there are. And they'll also tell you how many people ship coal by rail. And then they will tell you how many people are employed to burn coal in the United States. If you add all of those up, you come up to around 80,000 jobs. All of those.
So you're saying that twice as many people are now working in the solar industry as in the coal mines?
That's the photovoltaic industry and hot water industry. In the wind energy industry, the last number I looked at, and I could be wrong by some tens, but it was in excess of 120,000. So there's one and something times more people directly employed in wind energy today than there are in coal.
And so combining coal, combining solar and wind, there's more than, what, twice as, or even three times as many people employed in the wind and solar industries as there are in the coal industry.
Including the transport of coal and the burning of coal, yes.
And then, of course, then there's those two guys, the Koch brothers, we have to count them, and all their billions. And then, I guess in nuclear, I think there's about 100,000, maybe less. In the United States, I guess I could Google it while I'm talking to you, find out how many people work in the nuclear industry, and that leaves oil, right? And I guess gas. Gas is starting to employ a lot more people. But how many people work in nuclear power in the United States? Okay, let's take a guess here. What do you think, Fran?
I wouldn't know where to begin. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, I don't see it here. How many nuclear plants are there? We know that there are 100 in the United States. Ah, here we are. How many people are currently employed as nuclear reactor operators? About 4,000. So if there are 80,000 working in solar, there's 20 times as many people working in solar as in nuclear. That wouldn't cover that. You got to have uranium miners and operators like that. But I guarantee you there are more people working in solar than there are in nuclear in this country. That's for sure. And definitely more in wind. What kind of, when you did this 40 years ago, and God help us, it is 40 years ago, you had the Tour Tomorrow Fair. Did you have a vision of a future that would be 100% powered by renewables?
I did not, but reminding you that I'm also interested in the public health dimension, I did have a vision that we should make the world safe for human beings. And
what a concept! You mean more than corporations? That's hard to believe.
So one of the sort of founding guiding principles that I use in my work is the difference between price and cost. So a lot of times when the economists talk about the economic health of a society, they will talk about creating new jobs. And the discussion we just briefly had talked about jobs. But not all jobs are created equal. So, for example, if a child is riding his bicycle down the street and gets hit by a car and goes to the emergency room, the gross domestic product goes up. The quality of life is down, but the gross domestic product goes up because the doctor gets paid to do the operations and so on and so forth. On the other hand, if it's the doctor riding his bicycle down the street and he gets hit, the gross domestic product goes down because he's off the payroll.
That's why no, it's illegal for a doctor to ride a bicycle.
What the environmental community has, in my opinion, failed at is to count the cost. They get lulled into or lured into discussions of price. Solar is, quote, more expensive than, or wind is more expensive, or coal is cheaper. And it doesn't count all the human issues. We now know, for example, about the birth defects rate is rising. Most people do not know that there is no standard definition of a birth defect in the United States. Each of the states is free to have their own. Many of them have adopted a common one, and that definition is a defect visible at birth or several days thereafter. So if you're born with a cleft palate or limbs missing because of thalidomide or something like that, that's counted as a birth defect. When you're 3 years old and you've discovered to be autistic, that is not counted as a birth defect.
Jeez.
But we now know that the reason, the root issues of a lot of attention deficit disorder, a whole host of neurological issues, actually occur in the womb during the last trimester because of exposure to pesticides. There's a recent article out about the direct linking between a pesticide application and birth defects, astonishing numbers.
Yes, and of course you, with your public health background, understand that. Fran, I've only got 10 more minutes with you. I want you to talk about your new book and tell us what your website is, Discovering the New America, where local communities are solving national problems. And tell us where your website is and tell us about this book. It's very cool. I looked through it.
It's called The Optimistic Futurist. The website is www.theoptimisticfuturist.com. And the reason it's optimistic is for
every social... You have a .org.
.org. For every social problem that I identify, I don't care whether it's teen pregnancy or methane capture from landfills or recidivism from prisons, it doesn't matter to me. Every time I point to a problem and document it, I tell you a community or one or more that has successfully solved that problem in a way that we can imitate.
Well, give us some examples. Your book is filled with beautiful little stories about victories won by communities. So give us a couple of these, please.
Well, in Charlotte, North Carolina, there's a wonderful program where the prisoners who are coming out of jail or prison are taught to become chefs and work in the food industry. And the recidivism rate of people who go through that program is less than a fifth of people who do not go through that program, for example.
So these prisoners learn how to cook in jail, and then they never come back.
Well, not only in jail, but they're apprenticed to do it as a part of their probation and parole. But they're apprenticed to other ex-cons.
So we teach them,
and we're not talking about teaching them to cook. We're talking about teaching them to become high-end chefs. This is high, big money.
So give us another example of a community that's jumped forward and created a program to help.
Well, teen pregnancy avoidance is a big issue. There are far, what's the best indicator of whether a young woman is going to become pregnant when she doesn't desire to become pregnant when she's quite young? The single best indicator, she has an older sister who already did it. So there's a group in North Carolina that identified younger sisters of older that had older sisters who got pregnant out of wedlock when they didn't want to, and they contacted the older sisters and said, "Would you mind if we talk to your kid sister?" And they gathered together the kid sisters, and they asked them, "What kind of life do you want to have? Help us envision a positive future for you." And the young women envisioned positive futures. And the program had almost no sex education in it. It had everything to do with the positive vision of the future that we could get if we altered a little behavior. So although that particular program doesn't have anything to do with renewable energy, the pedagogical concept is exactly the same.
Well, Fran, give us the bigger concept then. You've got all these stories in there that are really inspiring of small groups of people in towns and so forth getting together and making a positive change. It's very inspiring, and I really urge people to get this book, Discovering the New America, Where Local Communities Are Solving National Problems by Fran Koster, the optimistic futurist. What is the overriding unifying theme of what you're saying here?
You do not wait for the federal government to do anything. You get four or five people together, identify the problem you want to solve. For example, if you want to solve high school graduation rate problems, start the day later for teenagers. A one-hour difference in the time you start the school day makes a huge difference in their graduation rate.
You're
because
kidding.
The biology of a teenager is that the biology tells them to stay up late and sleep late. You're going against nature if you make them get up real early to go to school. They sleep through the first 2 hours. So, and this is all, if you look at the book, you'll find all the academic footnotes there, also on my website. You can go in there and Google every problem from teen pregnancy avoidance to recycling to local food. And you'll get a list of communities that have launched successful programs that you can imitate.
So what time of day should school start for kids?
Well, again, we're talking about essentially the children entering puberty, because that's when their cycle shifts, their sleep cycle shifts. And the best time of day really has to do with what part of the country you're in, and it's a little more complicated than that. You have to localize it, but you don't start it at 7:30.
So 9:30, say, in the East Coast? I mean, give us a couple areas where you can tell us the best time.
What they found was that you could start the school day after 9 on the East Coast for kids of about puberty age. You saw a dramatic improvement in academic performance.
God, that's amazing. That's amazing. All right, give us one or two more examples. You got 5 more minutes. I'm just thrilled to hear this kind of stuff. Tangible things accomplished by small groups of people. I mean, your book is wonderful. It's just filled with all these things.
But one of the fascinating issues with local food supply is the people who grow food typically aren't very good salesmen. They tend to be introverts. They tend to be detail-oriented. They like working outside, and they're not real good at getting dressed in a suit and going to try and sell their, you know, watermelon crop or whatever. So there is a program, a computer program available, that local growers can band together, barcode their product. It's basically an eBay for food, for locally grown food, And the restaurants who want to buy the food go on the website, and if they want more watermelon or cantaloupe or onions than any one farmer has grown, they can aggregate produce. So if you've got a small production unit, you know, you've got grown on an acre or two, and the guy down the street's got one or two, neither one of you can sell to a supermarket because you're too small. The supermarkets don't want to deal with you. But you can aggregate this stuff using modern computer technology and make a decent-sized shipment, and they will buy it. Not only that, but you can predict when it will be ready. So you can get a salesperson to go to the market and say, August the 12th, we're going to have a whole bunch of unusual beans that we grew. Are you interested? If not, I'm going to the restaurant run by prisoners and tell them that they can get these unique vegetables and make a special dish.
Wow. Okay, here's one. I'm looking at the book. Hand washing. Tell us about hand washing.
If you say to people, did you wash your hand after you go to the bathroom, they'll almost always say yes, and they're almost always lying. It turns out that hand washing has two steps to it. You have to do it. You have to get your hands wet, and you have to do it for a certain period of time. And the habits we learn about washing our hands, we tend to learn when we're, you know, still not in school. We're youngsters. And mommy and daddy are teaching us to wash your hands after you go to the bathroom. A lot of that is taught wrong. And so in first grade or kindergarten, if a child is taught to wash his hands with soap and water, or her hands with soap and water, and recite the ABCs, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, by the time they get to Z, they have washed their hands enough that they have obtained maximum hand-washing purity. And when schools do this, their absentee rate goes way down. And interestingly enough, most people don't know this, but schools are not paid by the student. They're paid by the student who attends a certain number of days of school. So if you have a certain vulnerable population who's absent a lot, the school doesn't get paid for it. So it turns out that teaching hand washing increases the budget of schools.
Fascinating. Fran Koster, Aaron Klein, are you there? Are you still listening in?
Very intently, very interesting.
Okay, so I'm going to give you the last 10 minutes here. Fran Koster, it's been a joy and an honor to have you. My good old buddy, one of the few people who calls me Sluggo and keep on doing it, please. Your book is Discovering the New America, Where Local Communities Are Solving National Problems. Your website is www.theoptimisticfuturist.org. Fran, give us the final word. What do you want our listeners to hear from you? I will have you back at some point, but tell us now, what's your main message?
Go to my website. I write a new article every 2 weeks. They're peer-reviewed by experts in the field. You go to my website, you sign up, you'll be on my mailing list. I've got 3,000 people who get one of these new stories every time I write one. And I send out email to 5,000 people when I send. So if you want to be on the list and get the story that's not yet in a book, sign up.
Okay, theoptimisticfuturist.org. Fran, put me on. I'm not getting your articles, so send them to me. I'll post them at nukefree.org. And Fran Koster, let's stay in touch. It's really great to talk with you.
I really appreciate the opportunity, Father. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'll talk to you again. Okay, for the remaining part of our show, we have a really nice guy. I met him at a street fair in Teaneck, New Jersey. He's a friend of my kids, Abby and Achi, and he has a green business. Aaron Klein, tell us about Green Corners, please.
Yeah, sure, Harvey. Thanks for the chance here to be on the show. Very interesting guy you had on before, friend. So we started a company to help address the problem in the country of lack of public space recycling. So we have a lot of our communities, our municipalities, our schools focused on teaching our kids to recycle at home, curbside recycling, recycle in schools, parents to recycle in the office place, but there's very little attention paid to public spaces. And in fact, Keep America Beautiful stipulates that 88% of our public spaces are without recycling availability. And so that was the challenge that we looked to address and that gap that we looked to bridge here as part of our company. So we started Greener Corners, which places public recycling bins in these public areas. It's cost-free to our municipalities. We generate our revenue to keep our lights on through local business advertising on these units that we put out, so it has an economic stimulus piece as well. And we do some community education, awareness, and things of that nature so we can help build some more awareness behind public space recycling.
All right, this is very cool. So now, do you manufacture these receptacles? And how are the receptacles segregated? What do people put into what?
Great. So, yeah, we have a few different suppliers, manufacturers that we work directly with to customize the look of these things depending on where these are going. We have some programs on the East Coast, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and then we have something going on, two programs in Northeast Ohio, and then we have our flagship program in Colorado Springs. And depending on the community, Harvey, you have either you have your single stream where all the recyclables go into one place, or you segregate them, you divide them from commingle and mixed paper products.
Wow. Okay, so describe these receptacles, if you would.
Yeah, sure. So they are, my standard unit is about 6 feet long, 4 feet tall, and 2 feet wide. So, Harvey, you still there?
Yes.
I heard a phone ring. So you have...
That shouldn't be me. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, there's still a phone ring, but it's...
All right, well, let's just talk through it. It's okay. Aaron?
Yeah, hi.
All right, go ahead. Keep talking.
Sure. So we have these things thin, so they're ADA compliant, so we don't take up sidewalk space. So they're long. The capacity goes lengthwise, and then they're similar to your standard trash cans you have on the street as far as your height. So we're able to then incorporate up to 120 gallons of capacity in these units, which helps decrease the frequency of collection because you now have more space to put your materials.
And how many of these receptacles do you have? Are that, what, well, first of all, what are they made out of?
These are steel, galvanized or stainless.
And are they manufactured specifically for this purpose?
Sure, yeah. And we work with our clients, our municipalities, to help customize these so they match some of their current streetscape.
I see. So what municipalities have signed on with you so far?
Yes, so we have our programs, our headquarters are in North Jersey, so we have about four or five communities, really six communities now in New Jersey that have our program. We launched Long Beach, New York on Long Island, phenomenal program, wildly successful. That was only 6 weeks ago we launched that. We have a program on in eastern Pennsylvania in Allentown. The two in Ohio are Canton, home of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and Sandusky, Ohio, no relation to Jerry, but of course where Cedar Point is, and then our other programs in Colorado Springs.
Now, what happens to the stuff that goes into the bins?
So I contract either with a waste management type, a private hauler, or the city themselves, and they collect the materials. They get to reap the benefits of increased rebates from those materials that they wouldn't otherwise see on a public level. And our diversion rate can get upwards of 40%, which is, you know, a lot more being saved from our area landfills, which, of course, save these municipalities on landfill fees and tipping fees. So there is a financial benefit here as well.
And so you don't directly benefit from the recycled materials. What you do is you put the receptacles into areas, you contract to have them collected, and then you sell advertising on the receptacles themselves. Is that right?
Exactly right. You know, we didn't want to impede an existing contract or change the way things were done on the collection side. And the commercial side, the advertising side, is a really neat opportunity for businesses, local businesses, who can't otherwise afford to have a voice through the use of newspapers and billboards and such because it's just too darn expensive. We have exclusive places for these. There are no other advertising forms in the areas where we place these, so businesses can really stand out, get that voice. It follows along with the whole think local, buy local concept that we really are supporters of as well.
And how many receptacles do you have now out there in the public?
So we're close to 1,000 now, and we're hoping to continue the growth in the markets where we started.
And how are they color coded? What do they look like? Are they green, brown, yellow, red?
Yeah, and that depends on, again, the community. So Colorado Springs has a teal color theme throughout their downtown. Their benches, their lampposts, everything is this nice teal color, very aesthetically pleasing. So we really color match that exactly. And typically these are black, which is your standard, you know, steel-looking trash can, but, you know, we love to work with communities to make these match their current themes.
That's so cool. That's really cool. Now, you're in Teaneck, New Jersey, right?
I live in Teaneck, yes, sir.
No, I mean, but do you have the town under contract? Oh, 60 seconds. Oh, my God. Give us your I thought we could talk longer. Give us your website, Aaron.
Yes, Greener Corners, Greener, G-R-E-E-N-E-R, Corners with an S.com. Certainly can learn more about the program there. But my end piece before you have to run is we're looking to really push this public recycling mentality that we've been missing so far all along.
Very cool. We're done with, in the true entrepreneur spirit. Very good, Aaron. Thank you so much. GreenerCorners.com. This has been another fast-paced Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you, everybody, for being with us. The URL will be posted on Facebook for those of you looking for it on the archives. And thank you so much, crew in New York. And we'll see you again next week on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Take it away, Pete.
And that'll be Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, 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 don't you?